Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As the Democrats take over the House of Representatives, we will explore the difficulty they will have trying to find someone capable and competent to negotiate with. Since Trump is so unstable and totally out of his depth, no sooner will Nancy Pelosi have left the Oval Office thinking the deal is sealed, will Trump take to Twitter and reverse everything he had agreed to. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report and a former White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, who was counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss his article at Republic Report, "Say It With Me, Donald Trump is Weak." Instead of playing into Trump's hands by calling him dangerous, David argues that Democrats should point out that Trump is only dangerous in the way that leaving a child home with matches, an oven, and electrical outlets is dangerous. He is only dangerous because he's incompetent, narcissistic, insecure, and weak. Then we'll explore the looming consequences of Trump's pullout from Syria, where the latest American betrayal of the Kurds has them reaching out to the Assad regime for protection from the Turks. Thanasi Kambanis, a Lebanese-based journalist who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to Foreign Policy and the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, joins us. We'll discuss Trump's gift to Putin, Assad, Iran, and Turkey, and the tragic farce of an ally, the Kurds, having to turn to an enemy to protect them from another American ally, Turkey. Then finally, we will speak with Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics, who is currently the editor of Right Wing Watch and a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. She joins us to discuss how the emergence in 2018 of neo-Nazis and white supremacists from the shadows under Trump will metastasize on the global stage in 2019, as Steve Bannon continues to advise and strategize with far right-wing parties who are taking over governments in Europe from Poland to Italy after having already paralyzed the UK with their Brexit fiasco. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And his latest article at Republic Report is "Say It With Me, Donald Trump is Weak." Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And of course, today the Democrats take over the House and Trump thinks he's raining on their parade by handing them this government shutdown, which he's trying to blame on them. But frankly, it's so easy for the Dems to turn it around by sending a bill. Even they can send back the last bill that the Senate voted out on a voice vote and send it back to the Senate and let them deal with it and let Trump deal with it. But the long and the short of it is, I don't understand why the Democrats can't make the simple point that we are going to show competence in the face of rampant incompetence and point out that you can't make a deal with Donald Trump because you can't pin down a mercurial idiot. Because a minute after you think you've sealed the deal, he'll tweet out the opposite to what you agreed to. So can't they make that clear that there's nobody on the other side to deal with, whether it's McConnell or I guess the guy from Bakersfield now is taking over on the minority side in the House. But none of these people have any influence over Trump. And if you make a deal with Trump, literally a minute later, Ann Coulter's likely to say something on Fox and he'll blow up the deal.
I think the Democrats should continue to make clear that Trump is incompetent. And as I said in my article, weak. He's not dangerous. He's weak. He has no idea what he's doing. But I think that the government has continued to, the Congress has continued to pass bills in the end. usually when Trump sort of loses interest in it and goes on and invents another crisis for himself, and then whatever remaining semi-competent people in the White House can go in and try and make a deal. Some deal has to be made. People need to go back to work, and garbage needs to be picked up, and functions of government have to resume.
Well, let me read a piece from your article, which certainly got my attention at Republic Report. Say it with me. Donald Trump is weak. You say that Democrats have regularly played into Trump's hands from the 2016 campaign to the present by calling Trump dangerous. That makes Trump sound like James Bond. But Trump is not dangerous because he's some kind of malevolent, stable genius. He's only dangerous in the way that leaving a child home with matches, an oven, and electrical outlets is dangerous. He's only dangerous because he's incompetent, narcissistic, petulant, and insecure. He's only dangerous because he's weak. I think you've nailed it.
The way I started that article was to say that a lot of people voted for Trump because they liked the idea of white supremacy, no doubt. But I think there were other people who liked the idea of having a strong man, almost a villain, in the White House, someone who had a record of breaking the law, breaking the rules, of associating with unsavory people, of brawling in public, someone who would fight and fight dirty, but fight for them. And that all is a little bit ugly, but it's coherent. But what it turned out was his bark was a lot bigger than his bite. Trump has no idea how to get things done in government. And for all he's been doing that he's been good at is tearing things down with a tweet, like saying no more NAFTA, no more Iran deal, et cetera, he's never once actually effectively put something in place that's completed to actually make us safer, more prosperous. And he's been rolled over and over again by genuine strong men, evil people, but capable people, like the leaders of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and of course, in Russia, Vladimir Putin.
So when is the American public going to see the real Donald Trump? We understand that inside the Oval Office, there's this madman spouting insanity all day long, shouting at people, completely out of touch, and then going off and watching TV for most of the day, and then getting all riled up and tweeting out all kinds of nonsense. That's who this man is. And you recalled, David, when the Watergate tapes emerged with President Nixon cursing away, and people were shocked that the President of the United States used such bad language. If you multiply that moment where the scales come off the eyes by a million, that's what you would see if the American people got to see who the real Donald Trump is. So when are we going to cross that wall?
Well, for Trump's core supporters, we'll never cross that wall. They only want to see what they want to see. They only see what they want to see. Everything is about how he's strong and how he's helping them, although he's never once helped the working person. He's only helped big corporations and special interests. But I think it's part of this white supremacy wish dream that they have, and this idea that they don't want to be proven wrong about the man. They like a celebrity. They're never going to see it. The key is whether those people in the middle who voted for Obama or who otherwise could be persuadable might change their mind. And I think that still remains a difficult task. I think you're going to need a Democratic candidate who really projects strength, optimism, doesn't make the whole campaign about the fact that Trump is weak, but dismisses him as weak. Just says, you're a weak, incompetent leader. We need a better approach, and then explains what that better approach is. I think there's a chance Trump will be reelected still. And I mean, because our country has just kind of gotten mired in this not only sort of partisanship and chauvinism but also just because there's just a lack of education, there's a lack of understanding, and we've entered kind of a dark place where the very worst impulses can be riled up, whether it's by Russians pretending to be Americans or actual Americans like Alex Jones and people of that ilk.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And his latest article at Republic Report is, "Say It With Me, Donald Trump is Weak." So, David, at this moment, as I say, with the Democrats taking over the House, is, you know, the trap would be for all of the Democrats to still focus on the 2020 sweepstakes. And you've just said that Trump could actually be elected. And I hate to see us all bogged down deciding which one of the possible Democratic candidates could rescue us, like the man on the white horse, which I think is in itself a terrible trap. But what about backlash or blowback from the institutions that Trump is attacking? He's already attacked the FBI and the CIA. He's already attacked the Department of Justice, and he's completely politicized the judiciary. And it's possible that the Chief Justice Roberts is reacting to the politicization of the judiciary by voting more to the center and less to the right. But that's just a possible theory. But the one institution that he's just tried to desecrate, which has always been above politics, and that is the military, by politicizing the military as he did in those ridiculous speeches in Iraq and at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. That, could there be backlash? I mean, the military is now, the DOD is now run by a military-industrial complex creature, a Boeing executive, for God's sake, and they got rid of a very popular general. And just, you know, last week, General McChrystal really laid into Trump and basically said he was immoral and corrupt and lies, and that the American people have got to look themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, can we keep accepting that? If this guy were running a company, he'd be gone by now. So what do you think of that possibility? I'm looking around for a blowback to what the real damage Trump is doing, you know, having stacked the judiciary with these, you know, really bad right-wing, unqualified federal judges. That's going to do lasting damage.
Well, you know, in the military part, I did a piece on Republic Report on November 12th about, in the wake of putting Matthew Whitaker at Justice, will he replace Mattis with another sycophant? And that's a real danger that he puts in somebody that does go with the sort of political way Trump is treating the military and trying to turn them into a MAGA army. And that does stop slow walking ridiculous Trump orders, like pull out now of a country when, you know, lives could be at risk if you pull out too fast, or have a ridiculous military parade, or what he apparently said, let's assassinate Assad of Syria, when he got mad one time in last year. So if you don't put somebody in that actually has, you know, committed to the troops, committed to the Constitution, committed to the rule of law, that could be an even bigger catastrophe than having a sycophant running the Justice Department. Politicizing the judiciary, a lot of the judges that Trump supported, he's basically delegated that to Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society. So it's a lot of the same people that George W. Bush has appointed, except it's their younger nephews, because they're appointing, you know, people in their 30s, and they run out of qualified people. A few of the people he's appointed, while conservative, are actually competent. And there are, I think some of them are people like John Roberts, who actually are committed to the idea of the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law. So it's not as if all the justices are like Steve Miller, or judges are Steve Bannon. I think that Brett Kavanaugh proved himself, when pushed, to be the ultimate MAGA justice, who, you know, was just going to play to the base in order to win. And that was a disgrace. But yes, he's trying across the board to politicize these agencies. And as more and more people who actually have some commitment to our constitutional principles leave, it gets tougher and tougher to uphold those principles.
So at the Department of Defense, the biggest part of the budget, and the biggest government department, does he have a sycophant in this Boeing executive?
I think he will on some issues. And I think, unfortunately, on other larger constitutional and strategic issues, he has somebody who's not qualified And we don't know what he would do when push came to shove on executing orders that are illegal. As I said to you before, I'm concerned if Trump loses that he will try to stay and claim that the election was rigged. And there again, having an independent person in charge of the armed forces, a person of integrity, could prove to be incredibly important. So I think, you know, Trump did nominate Chris Wray to run the FBI after he fired Comey. He could have put in, you know, Steve Miller or Ivanka or Jared to that job. So there's going to be some pressure from the Hill to appoint a permanent Secretary of Defense who actually is a credible person. I don't know that anyone would take it after Mattis's letter basically saying that Trump has no idea what he's doing. But maybe we can get somebody in or have at least enough congressional oversight there. I just don't know. I mean, the Republican Senate is a very bad outcome for the next 2 years. It's too bad. It was a very close call. If you had a Democratic Senate, you'd have a much bigger check on continuing to load up the judiciary with right-wing, unqualified people, and you'd have a much bigger check on other things like who's going to run the Pentagon and the Justice Department. Unfortunately, there's been very few signs of any integrity and independence in the Senate. And the members of the Senate who did show some, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, John McCain, are all going to be gone.
Well, you know, when you talk about the restraints on Trump and the fact that he picked Christopher Wray, that was the old Trump. That was when there were still some adults around him. He's gotten rid of them all. And now his principal advisors are his daughter, Ivanka, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his... It's the dreadful Stephen Miller and Brad Parcells, his campaign guy. That's yep. It. You know, he doesn't listen to anybody else. So now that he's unfettered, that let Trump be Trump, that he's freed, I think he's infinitely more dangerous at this moment.
I think that's right. I do think that's right. And you know, the question is, you know, would somebody like Mitch McConnell or Lindsey Graham behave like an adult and not just a partisan, and try to actually impose some stability, some morality on the system? I don't know. It's a very perilous 2 years, you know, and soon it'll get swept up in the election. But I think, you know, the House Democrats can have some say in this. They have investigations. I've met with plenty of House staff in the last few months who are thinking about what they can investigate, to not do it in a way that looks, you know, like all they're doing is bogging the administration down, but exposing the bad actions, the corruption, the special interest influence on the administration in a way that might make it harder for the Trump administration to just act with impunity in the next couple years. But this is going to be, you know, this whole Trump presidency, including these 2 years, and especially with all, as you say, some of the semi-grown-ups who were there. I'm not sure that General Kelly or Rex Tillerson were all that great at being grown-ups in this administration. But this is, you know, this is the challenge to our republic. This is what, you know, were our institutions built strong enough to endure this kind of thing? It should lead to impeachment. It should have led, in my opinion, the Electoral College saying that Trump was not, you know, that's what the Electoral College is for, to make sure a scoundrel didn't become president. That didn't happen. Impeachment probably, or removal from office probably won't happen. But our institutions otherwise, our judiciary, our free press, our independent branch, legislative branch, are they strong enough to contain a madman for two more years? And I would say tune in. This has certainly become the greatest reality show of all time. It's repulsive, disgusting, regrettable, and we're missing out on the opportunities we really, you know, should have been taking to make our country actually great. But it is necessary, and everyone, as much as we all have Trump fatigue and are so repulsed and disgusted with the man, we got to stay with it. We got to keep fighting.
And you realize, of course, that I've completely contradicted the reason why I wanted to interview you, which is because you were arguing that the Democrats have played into Trump's hands from the 2016 campaign to the present by calling Trump dangerous, when in fact he's only dangerous because he's weak. And we just got through saying that now that a few adults have left him, all he's got are these ridiculous family members and this strange character from Santa Monica High. who has the most bizarre ideas, even though he writes good speeches. So,
and the weirdest hair transplant.
So just clear up that inconsistency, if you will, because I'm sure others might have noticed it.
He's dangerous because he's weak. He does have powers at his disposal. He hasn't effectively wielded them for the most part, but there are consequences of his bad policies. People are dying, children are dying in custody of immigration services, and alliances are being destroyed, and the Kurds are going to be slaughtered in Syria, potentially. My real point of the article is a rhetorical one. The Democrats, when they say Trump is dangerous, make him sound like James Bond, like somebody who actually might fight dirty, but will fight for us. In fact, he's done nothing to fight for working people. And his only danger is in his own narcissistic preening and lashing out, and that could have bad consequences. So, yes, he is dangerous. But if I'm running against him, or I'm advising the person running against him, I would say, Donald Trump, you've been nothing but an incompetent, weak president that has embarrassed our country. And then turn to the positive agenda. But saying he's dangerous makes it sound like he's a big man and he's a great man, and he's not. Even the most horrible scoundrels in our history and in our present world, the worst dictators and the most horrible dictators in our history, all more capable and effective than Donald Trump.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern as a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And his latest article at Republic Report is Say It With Me, Donald Trump is Weak. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back exploring the looming consequences of Trump's pullout from Syria.
Well, some people try and treat me like a man. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. Well, I guess they just don't understand. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. They think I know, but that's just it, I'm a child.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Thanasi. And as the year 2019 begins here, there obviously total disarray in your neighborhood, the Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, that neighborhood where the U.S. has been bogged down for some time. President Trump's sudden call to withdraw the 2,000 American troops without consulting his generals, his top aides, and his allies have obviously disturbed a lot of people, but now, not surprisingly, feeling betrayed by the United States, the Kurds are now asking the Assad government for protection. And if it couldn't get any more confusing in Syria, this amounts to a U.S. ally calling on an enemy of the United States to protect it from another U.S. ally. Go figure.
Yeah, the watchwords for the coming year are going to be uncertainty and restoration. We have, with Syria especially, a sort of overt overt effort to go back to the status quo, and we've seen normalization of relations with other various Arab countries, and Assad now in the final stage of trying to go back to the status quo ante and dominate his country. But the other countervailing force is complete uncertainty on the kinds of parameters that have really constrained what happens in the region, and the first and foremost of those being the United States. So we have for a long time been able to rely on knowing more or less what to expect from the United States in the region, and that's really gone out the window with Trump in huge ways, and that has ripple effects that we're only beginning to see. The Syria withdrawal was one of the most intense in recent times, but it affects everything from Iran to the Gulf to the Horn of Africa, and it really does it does mean that there's going to be a lot of uncertainty that gets negotiated by small or medium-sized armed conflicts that we haven't even begun to think about.
Well, it looks as though the Sunni Arabs in the Gulf are now figuring out the Saudis must have known that they've lost and their huge investment has gone nowhere. But the fact that the United Arab Emirates are reopening their embassy in Damascus and Bahrain is going to do the same thing as well as Kuwait would indicate to me that they've seen the writing on the wall. So do you think that the real end game here in Syria comes down to who's going to pay to reconstruct this devastated country that's largely been destroyed because of this family mafia? The Assads decided that the people have no right to rise up against them and demand any kind of democratic change, and they brought this catastrophe.
The game right now is about politics and political control. The reconstruction issue is a longer-term matter, and frankly, I don't think anybody's going to pay. We have estimates of a tab of something like $300 billion to reconstruct Syria. And when you look at the region and when you look around the world who has those kinds of pockets, China's not going to pay that. Russia can't. America won't. Europe won't. So no one's going to rebuild Syria, I think, in the next 10 or 20 years. What people will do is reestablish relations, trade intelligence for favors. We might see things like a power plant built by Europe in exchange for some kind of anti-jihadi intelligence cooperation. We'll see ports invested in by China, very sort of narrow bandwidth things like this. But the political game is the really important one. And you alluded to the opening of the embassies by the UAE and Bahrain. And we should note the UAE never actually went as hardcore anti-Assad as, say, Saudi Arabia did. But when UAE does something like this, we can always assume that's a trial balloon for Saudi, and I would expect one of the next steps is that Saudi Arabia, with its much more significant resources and energy pipeline, is going to reestablish relations with Syria. And Syria was readmitted to the Arab League also at the end of the year. And all this is a harbinger, I think, to the bigger unfolding battle, which I think we talk about every time we speak, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and sort of by proxy, Russia and the United States in the region. And that is a repositioning that is underway. And I think what we're going to find in the coming year is those boundaries are going to be tested. I think Saudi Arabia feels very insecure about what its patron, the United States, will do for it. And it's also going to begin to realize, as are a lot of America's unreliable allies in the Middle East, they're going to realize that they made a huge mistake by siding with Trump as opposed to siding with the U.S. government. And they're going to realize that Trump isn't forever, and when Trump is gone, they're going to have a huge price to pay, because the next government, even in theory if it's a Republican administration, but definitely if it's a Democratic administration, is going to be, I think, have a lot of scores to settle with these renegade, rogue Middle Eastern allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the UAE, which basically took a partisan tack on U.S. politics and have savaged U.S. national interest in the process.
So along with the Kurds being hung out to dry by the United States, it also looks as if Israel, I don't know whether you could say they're being hung out to dry, but they clearly can't be happy about the U.S. pulling out these 2,000 troops that sit aside the land bridge between Tehran and Damascus, which for a very small investment gives U.S. enormous leverage over Iran's ability to supply Hezbollah, even though they fly stuff in. It's worth noting just a few nights ago, the Israelis attacked the main airport in Damascus, and I believe a group of high-ranking Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Hezbollah leaders were getting on a plane to fly from Damascus to Tehran, and when the Israelis struck with missiles, and I'm not sure whether what kind of casualties they were, but it really incensed the Russians and apparently endangered, or they're claiming it endangered some international flights into the area. But that would indicate to me that the Israelis cannot be happy about Trump's withdrawal, and I always assumed that Netanyahu basically told Trump what to do.
Well, it's I still haven't figured out what happened there, whether that was a response to an Israeli request or a Turkish request, or whether this was Trumpian power politics at its purest. And his strategy seems to be to keep the world on its toes by being intentionally unpredictable and destabilizing. And I think he believes that America reaps benefits when when the world is in flux. And of course, my take is the opposite. Even in problematic places, even with really troubling regimes like Syria's regime or the Saudi Arabian regime or the Israeli regime, that when you're going to try to change things, you need to change them deliberately and ideally with a sort of mindful whole of government policy. And this is the opposite of it. So even if pulling out of Syria ultimately was the right thing to do, this is like pulling out with dynamite. You blow up the whole equilibrium in the process. And I doubt that is what Netanyahu wanted Trump to do. I doubt, frankly, this is what anybody wanted him to do. And even perversely, Assad is going to have trouble adjusting to such a sudden shift. Now, of course, he benefits ultimately, as does Russia. But nobody gets what they want in the way that they want it with this kind of sudden move. And I think one of the things that Trump hopes is that this gives the U.S. leverage. I would say it gives the U.S. the opposite. When we want partners in the region, or even reluctant partners or enemies that we negotiate with, when we want to pressure them to do things, they're going to have a lot of trouble trusting that whatever it is we're promising, that we're going to deliver it. And I think that is also one of the long tail legacies of this period. And this does actually stretch back to Obama's waffling in the region as well, but now it's much more accentuated. And that is, nobody any longer really believes that the United States is in any way committed in the Middle East, and more specifically, they don't trust that whatever promises it makes, that it's able and willing to keep. And that really changes the whole dynamic, not just for the U.S., but for the whole region.
But Thanasi Kambanis, surely there's another explanation short of Trump having this brilliant strategy to put everybody on their back foot by being so impetuous and not appearing to have any predictability or any consistency with what he does. The other explanation is that he's simply out of his depth and completely incompetent. And because he was on the phone to Erdogan, who's a real autocrat, and he kind of obviously craves autocrats. And, he was briefed by Bolton and by Pompeo and by Mattis to basically be tough, to protect the Kurds, and not to allow the United States to be bluffed by Turkey's threats to invade northern Syria. And instead, he completely caved in, and he obviously got an agreement out of Erdogan to back off pressure on Trump's buddy, Mohammed bin Salman.
For sure, Ian, I agree with you entirely. I didn't mean to imply when I said before that I think it's a brilliant strategy. I think it's an inane, destructive series of hapless maneuvers. I think Trump thinks that this is what that strategy is. In reality, it's nothing of the sort. And in fact, to pull back for a minute, I think what's happened in the last year, year and a half, almost guarantees a whole series of disasters in the next few years, one of which is going to be the rise of another version of ISIS. This is what happens every time the Levant is mismanaged or left with huge security gaps. So we have this guy. He alienates and insults the leadership of Iraq. He pulls the cork out of the bottle of what's left of stability in Syria. And of course, in the background, ISIS is still there. They're trying to reconstitute in the rural areas. The only way to prevent the rise of a new ISIS is to manage a real security coalition in the region with decent allies, of which we have, including the government of Iraq. And instead of building on the decent amount of success that came at the end of this counter-ISIS campaign, we've now seen, I think, almost all of that thrown to the wind. And this is, you know, the only language I think that a lot of Americans care about, unfortunately. But the one thing they do care about is terrorism. And even on by that metric, the U.S. has failed in its core aim. And of course, that's going to come at the cost of stability and well-being for millions of civilians in these countries. And that is something, you know, Erdogan's not going to solve this problem for the U.S. Saudis aren't going to solve it for the U.S. No one else can solve it for anyone else. It has to be done in concert with a central guarantor power helping make this happen, and that was the United States in the campaign against ISIS, and with the U.S. having willfully blown up that coalition and the relationships that it built, we're in for another very distressing ride.
Well, there's some talk that the British may send some troops in and that the French may. They have a small contingency in that area, that the 2,000 U.S. soldiers are basically, as you say, the cork in the bottle. They're keeping Turkey at bay, Assad at bay, the Iranians at bay, and also Russia at bay. We know that through a mercenary army owned by Putin's chef, Prigozhin, the Wagner Brigades, they, along with some of Assad's forces, tested the Americans a while back, and they got slaughtered. But the fact that they did it, and nobody can tell me that there wasn't coordination with the Russian military, but these guys were kind of expendable, and they got absolutely crushed. So why did they do that? That was obviously they're testing the U.S., and they got a stern rebuke. Now we're doing the opposite. So it's not difficult. It's almost inevitable for one to think, well, why is this again Trump doing a favor for Putin? I mean, we remember the Helsinki press conference. There was something strange going on there where he sided with Putin against his own government and his own intelligence service. This time around, he's done the same thing against his Secretary of State, against his Secretary of Defense, against his National Security Advisor. And the only person who's praising the withdrawal of the 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria is Vladimir Putin.
Well, there's no doubt that Trump has a deep affinity for autocrats, and we see this not just with his admiration for Putin and for Duterte in the Philippines, but his clear affection for the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, the man who's a mass murderer and also a very flamboyant murderer of assassin of specific people we know, like Jamal Khashoggi. Trump likes this. He likes these people individually. He admires the way they rule, and that has real poisonous consequences for American foreign policy, especially at a time when foreign policy is personalized in one individual. The people whose advice Trump has disregarded aren't in any way great policy advisors to begin with, right? These are the sort of dog's lunch of hawks and grifters and weak characters, with a few exceptions like Mad Dog Mattis, who was too radical and destabilizing to work for Obama. But when he ended up in Trump's cabinet, he was considered the adult in the room. I just remind us of that to say that the people we were counting on to be brakes on Trump were already dangerous characters to begin with in policy terms. And Trump doesn't listen to those people, to any of these people. And he does listen to folks like Putin and Erdogan when he talks to them on the phone, because he thinks of them as kindred spirits, you know, unitary executive leaders who've managed to personalize a country in one person. And that is, in my view, sort of the most un-American approach to leadership you can think of, right? America is about an idea and a set of rules that transcends any given individual. And I think Trump personifies an opposite view, a sort of monarchical, dictatorial idea of the nation as a person. And, you know, the place where he can do the most destructive damage with that approach first is in the international arena, where there's just fewer checks and balances from institutions. And he's trying to do that at home as well. It just takes more time to destroy the institutions and the rule of law domestically. But there's no doubt he's trying to do all those things at once, and that he takes lessons and cues from these foreign leaders.
Well, just in closing, Thanasi Kambanis, looking ahead to 2019 in that dangerous region where you are in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, and Israel, it would seem to me that if the adults are gone and there's still a sycophant in Pompeo and a hawk with Bolton, but if he's not even listening to them, then who is he listening to? And what I understand is he's listening to Stephen Miller. He's listening to Brad Parcells, his campaign guy. And he's listening to Ivanka and Jared. And Jared's peace plan is going nowhere. But is it possible that these are the people that are going to be advising Trump in foreign policy in 2019?
I have no doubt that it's possible. And I wouldn't discount that he's going to be taking advice from these very foreign leaders whose interests he's most helping to propel. And I think what we're going to see is a scramble by figures in the world who see Trump's days as numbered to maximize whatever advantage they can reap while this clown is still in office. And I think that's a very dangerous it's a very dangerous window, because I think they see maybe a year and a half where by hook or by crook, they can try and maximize their control over areas like Syria, their commercial relationships with Iran, Saudi Arabia, elsewhere, and there'll be a scramble, and I think Trump will be a willing participant.
Well, just to end on a more conspiratorial note, it would seem to me that if Trump is owned by Putin, which a lot of people think he's sort of a Manchurian candidate, if Putin knows that Trump's days are numbered because of Mueller, and he would know how guilty Trump is because I think he's a co-conspirator, is it possible that Putin's getting his favors in as quickly as he can while he's still got Trump in there? You know, pull out of Syria, give me a massive gift, and the next shoe to drop is pull out of NATO.
I think I like to hope that there's too many checks on such a radical move, but for sure, Trump has already done quite a fair bit of bidding to undermine NATO and to erode the world's trust in America's deep commitment to NATO, which has real consequences. And one imagines if Russia were to invade Estonia or Lithuania or Latvia today, would America honor its NATO commitment the way it has historically? And I think that doubt has been one of Trump's great gifts to Putin. I hope your deeper fears are not warranted, but I think in this climate, anything is possible.
Sure. And it sounded as if Trump was laying the groundwork for a pullout of NATO in his speech to the American troops in Iraq last week, where he said we're suckers and we're not going to be suckers anymore. In any case, let's hope that 2019 is not as bad as it looks. And I thank you for joining us, Thanasi Kambanis.
All right, and happy 2019.
Thank you.
You your listeners again.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the neo-Nazis and white supremacists who emerged from the shadows under Trump in 2018 will metastasize on the global stage in 2019 as Steve Bannon continues to advise and strategize with far right-wing parties in Europe.
اكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently the editor of Right Wing Watch, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to Sirius XM Progress. Her latest article at The American Prospect is Trump and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And we've just done a sort of retrospective of Background Briefing through 2018, and there's no question that Charlottesville was one of the biggest events of 2018 and the most disturbing, in as much as the racists and white nationalists and white supremacists who had essentially been driven underground and shamed have been invited back into the open, feeling emboldened by the presidency of Donald Trump. And we saw them strut their stuff at Charlottesville and the mayhem that followed. But I'd be interested in getting your take on both the underpinning of this and its international appeal and the extent of the role of Stephen Bannon, who seems to be at the forefront of this revival, and he's sort of weaponizing it geopolitically, because he's supporting all of these horrible right-wing politicians in Western Europe who, at the end of the day, are doing Putin's bidding. So I'm curious to understand. I mean, I don't understand why the Republican Party is in collusion with Putin. We perhaps know why Trump is, because he's compromised. But I don't understand why the Republicans are so compromised by their relationship with Putin that they don't seem to want to get out ahead of Trump and repudiate what's really going on. So when you scratch the surface, you always end up with Stephen Bannon.
Yes, there's something to that, at least in, you know, nationalist, in terms of the popularization of these nationalist ideas. Yes, we did just have the first anniversary of the Charlottesville melee, and, you know, it was Bannon who later, after he left the White House, really expressed his just disgust with anybody anywhere near Trump who had any problems with Trump, having said after these so-called white nationalists or neo-Nazis or whatever had you know, done all that mayhem all over Charlottesville and ultimately won among their member killed a woman and maimed many more counter-protesters at that event. You know, Bannon was like, no, you don't back down from that. And we do see this in Europe with Steve Bannon and what is going on with him. He has created this thing he's calling, capital T, capital M, the movement, and under which he is it's a so-called foundation that through which he is going to provide, you know, strategy and communications advice to the candidates of the right-wing parties, the far-right parties of Europe. Now, there has long been interplay between the American right and the right wing of Europe, and even some love for Putin. We saw this with Richard Spencer's brand of white nationalism. But we've never seen anybody try to organize the nationalist parties, the far-right parties, the racist parties of Europe to a common cause. Now, my belief is, Ian, that what Bannon's really up to is smashing up the EU. Because, you know, there's no way nationalist parties, a whole bunch of nationalist parties, can really hang together if they're truly nationalist, right? That means you're all about your own country. But they might hang together long enough to effect busting up the European Union. And we've, you know, found belatedly that these same forces were behind the Brexit vote in the referendum in Britain, that Nigel Farage has been, you know, in cahoots with Bannon for a long time, and Cambridge Analytica was said to be involved in that, and that's a company, a data company, that was owned by Robert Mercer, who contributed oodles of dollars to many Bannon enterprises, and of which Bannon himself was an executive vice president.
Well, they've done a hell of a job with Brexit. It's completely paralyzed the United Kingdom.
Right.
Politically paralyze them and damage their economy. And it's been such a low cost. I mean, the Russians managed to funnel some money through a British insurance magnate who's married to a Russian woman who's alleged to be an FSB officer. So that was a very small investment with a huge payoff, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. One of the things that's disturbing about Trump, particularly his recent speech before the troops in Iraq, where he talked about freeloading and about how America's the sucker and we're not going to be the sucker anymore.
Right.
He's clearly talking about NATO, because that's how he's characterized NATO, as a bunch of freeloaders. And the other shoe that could drop after he gave Syria to Putin is that he could start withdrawing troops from NATO. And he says he's going to take half of the troops out of Afghanistan, which, frankly, may not be such a bad idea, since after 17 years, you'd wonder at what point we're going to admit that it's not going anywhere. But
it's not a winnable enterprise,
yeah. But pulling out, if that's to happen, and I suspect it's going to happen soon, Bannon, he'd be climbing the walls and celebrating with
declaring victory, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the ideology, though? Is it because, like Spencer, these characters see Putin and Russia as the last holdout of the white man and of Christendom?
Yes, exactly. Those are exactly the terms I would use. It is the exemplar of a white patriarchy, authoritarian state that claims the mantle of Christianity through the Russian Orthodox Church, which is a politicized authoritarian body and is the state religion. So yes, that is basically the appeal of Putin, if you want to get into an ideological explanation for it. I mean, with Trump, we think there's more, you know, sort of quotidian issues there with who he owes money to, where he got his money from, what the Russian government knows about all of that. But it all seems to be working towards the same ends. Now, your point about NATO is really particularly salient. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, only a couple of weeks ago addressed NATO in Europe, in Brussels, and he shocked the member states by suggesting that organizations, multilateral organizations such as the United Nations and the European Union, may have outlived their usefulness. I mean, it was shocking. And it was just that there was so much other stuff going on, Trumpian stuff going on, that, you know, kind of flew under the radar. And so if you undo the EU and you undo the United Nations, I mean, what's to keep NATO standing at that point, right? So I think it's very important. It's a very important point. And John Kelly, the chief of staff, Trump's chief of staff, who is on his way out of the White House, even as we speak, gave an interview, I believe, to the Los Angeles Times, in which he said, you know, one of the things that he kept Trump from doing, or maybe he wasn't he himself who said this, maybe one of his associates said this, was to have kept Trump from pulling out of NATO. Now, Kelly, for better or worse, is on his way out. He's leaving. Who's going to stop Trump from pulling out of NATO now?
Well, Trump's inner circle is now reduced down to his daughter Ivanka, his son-in-law Jared Kushner, Brad Parcells, his campaign guy, and Stephen Miller, the peculiar fellow with such hostility towards immigrants and rather strange ideas, who came out here from Santa Monica High School, and his class project, when I think he was running for some school government position, and his speech was, he chose the issue to run on was that the janitors at Sam O'Hai were being paid too much money and weren't picking up the trash.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that makes an insight into the kind of quality of the people and their peculiar ideas that Trump hires. So that's
and it's interesting that Miller, you know, is still there because he is very much part of the Bannon. He was part of the Bannon faction of the White House.
Right, but if you thought things were bad before, with the so-called adults in the room who prevented Trump from pulling out of NATO earlier, they're gone. You've got these lightweights, and you've got a couple of sycophants like Pompeo and Bolton, who clearly don't stand up to this guy and don't speak truth to power. So as much as he's a weak man, and he's dangerous because he's weak, he's also dangerous now because he's unfettered.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And he is weak. This is the classic kind of wounded animal scenario, right? Or maybe more correctly, a rabid beast. But nonetheless, Trump is very dangerous because he has wounded himself so badly. And and it's said that he's not even listening to what Jared and Ivanka tell him these days. I mean, so it's really just him in his bedroom watching Fox News, you know? I am really terrified. I really think that we really have to be thinking about effective resistance at this point. We really, really do. And, you know, I often turn inward, and when I do, I'm wondering why I'm not out in the street right now. Why aren't we all out in the street? But why am I not out in the street? You know, this is really, we are teetering on the brink of the loss of the whole American project of democracy, the best thing about this nation. And I just don't know how it's going to turn out. Now, you know, God bless them. The Democrats are taking back the House of Representatives. They have done that. But, you know, they really can't pass any legislation because the Senate remains firmly in the hands of the Republicans. So really all they can do is demonstrate the program they would pass if they could by passing things that are then going to be, you know, either killed or left to die in the Senate.
Well, you know, Mussolini had the black shirts, Hitler had the brown shirts, and Trump has the red caps.
But yes, indeed, and so, Proud Boys, people
so,
like that.
Yeah, so what, just in the last minute, what should the opposition, which is by far the majority of Americans, so what could they coalesce around?
Coalesce around as an issue?
Yeah, just as simple as Make America Great Again has coalesced this new sort of neo-fascist movement in this country. Is there a simple fix here or anything that comes to mind as we go into this turbulent year?
You know the problem with liberals and progressives, Ian. We think too much. Nothing's simple. So I would just say democracy deserves to live, you know?
Right. Well, on that note, from your lips to God's ears, may
the goddess's ears, Ian.
I'm sorry. I can't get rid of my vestiges of being an Australian male. You know, I do try, but thank you for joining us. I appreciate it very much, Adele.
Great. great to be with you. Happy New Year.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently the editor of Right Wing Watch, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her latest article at The American Prospect is Trump and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.